Michelle Gurk grew up in suburban Melbourne. Her mum, Jean, was a bit on the glamorous side, never less than smartly turned out. Jean worked as a milliner, a hat maker, in a prestigious department store. After Michelle's dad died, Jean remained active in her community, and she even worked as a lollipop lady at the school crossing. But then Michelle began to notice that Jean was forgetting things, missing doctor's appointments, getting confused over dates and times, and her mum was eventually diagnosed with dementia, with Alzheimer's. And Michelle, who'd been out and about, living in the world, doing meaningful work in places like El Salvador, well, she fell into the role of primary carer for her mother. Over the years, mother and daughter had been loving, but not always close. But as Jean aged and began to lose her memory, the lives of these two very independent women became entwined. Michelle has written a memoir about the tender, painful, and sometimes blackly funny final year that they spent together. It's called Fraying: Mum, Memory Loss, the Medical Maze, and Me. And aside from being a memoir, it also contains practical information for anyone else about to cross that bridge. Hello, Michelle.
Hi, Richard.
There's a picture of you and your mum we're going to put on our website, I think, or our Facebook page, and it's a fantastic picture. There's you and you're kind of full of life and vitality, yeah. And your mum's not much different, except she's got all this war paint on, like lots of makeup, painted eye, like she blue eyeshadow, and she's all frocked up. And was she like that every day, pretty
that
much?
That was the way she liked to present herself to the world.
She's like a right bird in that, yeah. She is. All that amazing makeup. She's like a woman from the Kennedy era, isn't she? Like the 1960s Mad Men era.
Yeah, very stylish. When I was small, I didn't realise so much, but after Mum died, we had these old videos or old movies, and a cousin had them transferred onto DVD. And I didn't realise, I was only looking at those now that I see how stylish she was. But, you know, as a child, you don't think about that, how stylish your mother is.
No. Yeah. Paint me a bit of a picture of her before she began to experience dementia in her retirement years.
Yeah. Well, actually, she wasn't retired. She kept working as a lollipop lady. So she took that up at 59 when most people consider that they're going to retire. And my poor father, who was 7 years younger, thought by the time he retired that she'd retire. But no, she wanted to be out in the community. She said it kept her young. She would take time off occasionally to go on a trip with Dad in the car around Australia or something like that. But she just loved being in the community and doing her lollipop job. She had an incredible social life, like Friday night at 4:15 or 4:30, she had drinks with old friends that Dad had grown up with. She had the neighbours. This one neighbour had grown up in a culture not used to alcohol, and she was Buddhist. And after a few years, Mum had her coming in for regular drinks and brandies. And Mum was just a contributor. And we grew up in a very small community, suburban, in the sense that Mum helped build the school, the church, the tennis club. So we were part of those communities, and Mum continued to be part of those communities. So you couldn't go up to the shops, even when she was 88, still working, without her running into people who stopped and talked to her.
Oh, right. So she was really embedded in the community.
Absolutely.
She lived in there. And the family home, that was a big part of it too?
Absolutely. My mum and dad had grown up, well, my mum, because she was older, she'd grown up during the Depression, and her father was a baker, so he was never out of work. But they only lived in rented accommodation, whereas my father, completely different. They had their own house, but his father was often out of work. So he'd ride his bike, and when they heard the billy can rattle, they knew he was out of work again because he was bringing the billy can home. So my mum, her dream, apart from getting married and having children, was to have a house that they would own. That was a really big dream. And I have these photos of her and the house being built. And she said watching every bit of the wood going up and the walls was just like watching part of her dream appear.
Gee, they were such a different generation to us, weren't they?
Very
and their dreams are really
so.
Different, and the Depression affected everything. And
absolutely. Yeah.
Was she religious too?
She was incredibly religious. She, well, Catholic. And
was she socially Catholic or truly religiously Catholic?
Truly, like mass-going, a woman all that? Of incredible faith. And she was sort of a pillar of the Catholic Church in the local community. It meant a lot to her. Like I I went through all that Catholic upbringing, but it didn't mean to me what it meant to her. And these old pictures, you know, those old ones of the Sacred Heart, anyone who's grown up Catholic, and she'd touch them and it meant a lot to her. But it was sort of from another era. It wasn't what I could relate to, the icons and things like that. And when she got older, she had this incredible devotion to Mary, the mother of Jesus, so that even when she'd be in hospital, she'd have this fridge magnet, and it was about, I don't know, 6 centimetres across. And to her, that was more important, or as important, as the line of oxygen keeping her alive.
She worked, as I said, as a milliner, a hat maker. Yeah. Whereabouts did she work?
She worked at George's.
Oh, George's. Yeah. That glamorous old, that was the kind of number one department store.
Absolutely.
In Melbourne, wasn't it? It was quite posh.
Very, very posh. And they only had the best milliners or seamstresses there. And Mum told me people would come in, and this was in the heyday of outfits, you know, when women... You know, women might only have one or two lovely outfits, but they were beautiful and they were, of course, finished with a hat. So they would bring in the outfit and then she would design the hat and to make it to within an eighth of an inch, as it was in those days. And if it was any more than that out, she had to remake it. So she might take a week making one of these incredible creation. So you can imagine, as a little girl going to church, I looked like a Mexican some days, a Russian another day. I just had all these incredible hats I used to wear.
And did she give that skill to you? Did she pass any of that on to you?
Absolutely.
You weren't
not.
Interested, or she wasn't interested in passing it on to you?
Oh no, she was amazing. She I remember being 10 years old. I wasn't interested to make hats, but sewing, I mean, that's very useful. Even my husband now, he has to sew up his fishing nets, because he's a fish scientist. So sewing's very useful. So, Mum, she taught me how to sew. Like, I had a little doll about half the size of Barbie, and I was about 10 years old, and she taught me how to make a little pantsuit. But the inside had to be as good as the outside.
Ah.
And that's actually one of the
was
seams.
Was it a lined pantsuit, essentially?
No, but the seams, there the couldn't seams, be right. any fraying. Okay. That was one of the things.
Tell me how your mum and dad met each other.
Oh, they met at, of course I wasn't there, but the story was told so many times. They met at the Trocadero Dance Hall. And Mum would have looked gorgeous because she had her naturally blonde wavy hair, sort of lovely bust, petite waist, luscious sort of hips, and she would have been decked out beautifully. And Dad had his pinstripe Johnny the Tailor suit, and he was a tall, strapping man. So there was, I don't know, new measurements, but there was a foot difference in height, 5'4" to 6'4".
And 6 years difference in age to your mum was older.
Yeah.
That of course, no one would think anything of that today. But was that controversial at all back then?
I wonder. It was one of the controversial things because when they met, Mum didn't realise Dad was only 19. She only found out 2 years later when he had his 21st. She just went home and cried.
Wow.
Yeah. But worse, she was Catholic and he wasn't. He was Protestant.
Oh, that was a big deal in those days.
That was very big deal.
So did someone have to get permission from a priest or a minister in order to get married? And all
Dad said, in a way, we were almost bastards, us kids, because they never got married right on the front altar of the church. It had to be at the side.
Oh,
so we're
idea.
The kids from the side.
So you said your mum in the later years was a lollipop lady, and this is all being part of she. How many years did she do that for anyway?
30 years.
30 years.
Yeah.
Mother-daughter relationships are often fraught. I've sort of observed them from the outside. Yeah. I can't make sense of them. I don't know. Were you all, no, it's always really fraught. And when men inquire, it's like, just keep out of it. You know, it's like that. So I have to ask one question about it, though. Was it complicated? Was it up and down, your relationship with your mum over the years?
Totally.
Right.
Totally.
Right.
So I'll give you a couple of short little scenarios, because then you'll see through age what happened. I'm probably about, I don't know, 10 or 11, and I've got to go to Brownies, and it's Saturday afternoon, but I'm a mad Hawthorn supporter. For Easter, Mum didn't give us Easter eggs so much as a football season's ticket. And Peter Hudson, our magnificent goal kicker, is going to kick 100 goals. And I've got a little transistor radio, and it's history in the making. And I desperately want to listen to that moment. It will never happen again. And I tell Mum, I'm not going to Brownies today. And she says, yes, you are. So, you know, I have to do my badge and all of that. And basically, the older I get, the greater my resistance.
Right. You remember that. I think that's fantastic.
I have never forgotten that.
But you will go to Brownies, young lady.
Yes. Peter Hudson didn't kick his 100th goal that day, so I got to do it the next week.
There were times, as an adult, you must have freaked her out occasionally too. The men you was dating, did that happen?
Yes, that definitely. I think lots of things freaked her out. I think, you know, Mum came from a small community and family was everything. Mum and Dad both had about 3 siblings each and we knew all our cousins. We grew up with them. So it was a small world, really. And like my aunt lived 2 suburbs away. But I brought home an Arab African Muslim. This is before most of society in Australia had really thought about Islam, and then my mother was, yes, in shock.
I bet.
Actually, I was living in Sydney working for the Australian Tourist Commission, and I flew down to tell them that Mum and Dad that I'm going to get married, and I went back on the plane without having told her. I just couldn't stand the thought what the reaction would be.
It's a big deal for her to marry a Protestant. So, a Muslim would have been a big bit of a stretch for her.
When I used to go overseas, for example, to see him, I didn't tell Mum and Dad. I'd just say, I'm going to a conference in Singapore.
You were living in El Salvador for a while, Michelle. Mm-hmm. Tell me what you were doing there.
I started off doing human rights work, and there is a saying, and I think it's true, and I think it even applies here, how dangerous it is to take people by the hand, because before you know it, they've taken you much further than you'll ever think you'll go. So,
and that's what happened to you.
That's my story.
You were taken in the hand, or did you take someone else by the hand?
A bit of both, really. Yeah. So, yeah, I just went to a pub one night and met a bloke, and I was studying at university. I didn't go to university till I was 28, and I was doing third world politics and Spanish. And then there was, you know, a lot of the Salvadoran Civil War was on.
That was a horrible crisis. That was awful.
Terrible.
Death squads roaming the countryside, people murdered en masse. It was awful. This country's still recovering.
So outside of the worldview, my suburban worldview. So I thought, well, I've got Spanish. I can do the human rights denunciations. And then that led to me going to meetings in Nicaragua because it was too dangerous in El Salvador. And once you meet people, and I met the community leaders, they're not statistics or it's not a war over there. It's relational. And the relational pulls you in. And you see what incredible things people can do in community with so few resources. So that really inspired me.
Were you in contact with your parents while you were there?
Yes, but at that time, well, I used to go back and forward, and I only actually went to El Salvador towards the end of the war for a few months, and then I went back to live there once peace had happened. But at that time, there weren't computers.
No.
And it cost $8 a page to send a fax.
So how would your dad keep in touch with you then?
Oh, Dad used to, he was wonderful. He used to go around, you know, had a little tape recorder. And he'd help lots of people. He'd trained as a mechanic and he could fix anything. So he'd go around and he'd be at my brother and sister-in-law's house and he'd say, oh, look, I'll just fix the sink or the drain here. While I'm doing that, you talk to Michelle on the tape. Or he'd be over at my cousin's house and the same thing.
And did your mum speak on those tapes too?
Yeah, she did one, not so much, but I remember one Christmas day and I wasn't there. And we always had our Christmases together. She just burst into tears.
What was it like for you to hear that on the other side of the world?
Oh, a little bit sad. I mean, when you have your celebrations, it's lovely to be in community. I love the idea that at 28, I started learning another language and I could dive into another culture. And wow, it's like putting on a mask and snorkel and discovering a reef for the first time. There's other worlds there and I didn't know about it. So I had lots of amazing things like that, but your family is still your family and there is no one else. Your mum is the only mum you get in that life. So you do feel a bit sorry for her that you're not home for her, but that's the price sometimes.
Where were you when you got the news that your dad had died, Michelle?
Oh, that I'd been working in El Salvador for 18 months, and I was actually on my way back to Australia because we were bringing out this extraordinary human rights woman, and I was going to be her interpreter. So we decided, she'd never been out of El Salvador before, so we decided that we would go, I'd go to the States first and do some public speaking, and then she would come and we'd fly to Australia. And I got up to the US, I don't think I even did one night of public speaking, and I got a phone call. They came banging on the door at 8 o'clock in the morning saying, you've got to ring home. And I just said, I know, like, the only time I ever got rung when I was overseas was someone had died. So I said, is it my mum or my dad? And did they die? And they said, it's your dad, and he died. And I just couldn't believe it, because mum had had over 20 major operation, open heart surgery, thyroid. She'd been bitten on the chin when she was a little girl, about 3 or 4, and all the poison had raced her ear. So she had bone removed behind her ear, and she'd had a lot of complicated operations. And dad had never been sick, and he was younger. And he just dropped dead, had a stroke.
So how did your mum take to living alone? And was she alone after your dad died?
Well, I think that's why her job as a lollipop lady on the school crossing became so important. It gave her, she would be the first to say, it gave her a reason to get up in the morning and get going.
What were the very first signs of your mum's failing memory?
Actually, I remember this quite well. It was my 50th birthday, and we were trying to tell her that I wasn't having a big celebration, but I really wanted, mum was just the most fantastic cook. And I said, could you just cook me that roast lamb followed by homemade chocolate pudding in its own sauce? Like, that'd be wonderful. So my husband, who at the time was my partner, and my cousin came for dinner. So it was really special dinner. But my cousin got there earlier, and she said to me later, your mum really struggled to do that, like get the roast potatoes at the right time, and, you know, which if you unpack that scenario, there's a lot in it. There's a lot of logistics in it. So that was on one night, and then a few of us were going out for dinner a couple of nights later. And I remember she couldn't quite, I had to explain it a lot. I had to write it on the calendar. She just couldn't quite click it into her memory.
Had you ever seen anyone go through that before, this process of dementia, the onset of dementia?
Actually, that's a really interesting question. I don't think I had.
So it was all completely new to you as this started
to happen? Totally new.
Did you start watching out for things?
I did, actually. Yeah. I mean, a bit later. So that was in the May. And the issue was this. Mum was a lollipop lady on a school crossing on a very busy road. So if she was having memory problems, was she losing cognitive ability? Was she able to react as you would need a crossing supervisor to react? So that became really important. Sorry, I don't think I answered your question.
No, I see what you mean, though. There's something you needed to keep an eye on there. So you needed to have it tested then at some point.
We did. And I suppose one of the things I thought, well, I'll leave it to the medical professionals. But one day we went to have I think it was a brain scan, and we were sitting in a little cafe waiting for the radiographer or whoever does the report, and two things happened. And one was I said something about where we were, and mum knew this area well, but she couldn't quite work out where we were. And I said, well, you know, that's Coles over there. And she said, oh, yes. But I wasn't convinced. Oh, yes, was true recognition. And then she insisted she would pay for the two coffees, but the coins she gave me were nothing like what should cover that. And then I thought, okay, I need to not just rely on medical people. I'm around her quite a bit. I need to start looking.
Was she concealing her failing memory?
I think my mother had really well-developed social skills, like incredible. She was a gregarious, out-there person. She loved company.
Right, so she could bring a lot of social energy to anything. So that would actually, I don't know if you call it deception, but it would certainly might not make memory loss or that perceptible to someone who was talking
and
with her.
The other thing, Richard, is when you're at the start of this, how do you actually know? Like, how would she know? She might think it's just part of aging. How would I know? I had a whack on the head a few years ago and, you know, it sort of affected me a bit. And I think now, well, my memory's not as good as it used to be. Is that because of the injury or because I'm aging?
Well, you're doing great today.
Thank you.
That's all I can say. So, but your mum was kind of a bit antsy around the whole idea of being tested for anything, wasn't she?
Oh, yes. But that goes back to, I mentioned to you before that my mum had been bitten on the chin by a dog and the poison had gone to her ear. And they didn't realise when she went to school that she was deaf in one ear. So, you know, before computers and that, kids had to be able to spell. So every time they would have a spelling test, she couldn't hear properly, so she couldn't write down the sounds.
Oh, your poor mum, right.
So, and she had a really smart older sister. So she'd get her page back with red crosses all over it, and she didn't know. And then everyone would start calling her dummy. So she thought,
that's who
every
I
time,
am. Yeah.
And so any time a test or its modern equivalent assessment comes up, that is so embedded in her neural pathways and who she is and into her identity that she, yeah, does panic. She did panic.
Testing equals cruelty in her mind then. So how did her first, very first memory test go then, given her at home by a community nurse that she had?
Yes, well, that was something. That was really something. In fact, that is one of the inspirations I had for writing the book because I was an observer. I mean, this all of this was new to me. But I watched the community nurse and there was something about the diction that was hard for mum. So there's this one part where you have to say three monosyllabic words like car, man, ball, and then they'll talk to you for a couple more minutes and repeat those words. But mum couldn't repeat them in the first place because she couldn't hear. And we had explained that mum was deaf in one ear. So in the end, the only way mum could cope was to turn away from the assessor so that what she said was being heard in her good ear. But she lost all visual cues, which we all know are so important to communication.
And did you explain that to the assessor, that there was a hearing issue with your mum?
We had explained it before, but
Just didn't sink in with the assessor then, no.
I think, and also you have to remember these people, they're under the pump, you know, they've got schedules, they've got to get through things. It's a first time meeting mum. So
what kind of result did she get out of the memory test, which was part of a hearing test, as it turns out, too?
She got 22 out of 30, and apparently if you get under a 23 or 24, you've got a problem with your memory. So,
But you couldn't trust that result then, by the sound of things.
No, but that was the first one to put you into the system. So it said that mum had a problem. So, and then trying to say perhaps she shouldn't be driving. So it was very difficult. And, of course, that's the first time I'm an observer. So you don't know how much should I interrupt. I didn't think I should say anything.
What do you think about the test she had now, all those tests? She had many tests.
She had loads of tests.
Yeah, what do you think about that process of getting tests then, how reliable that might be?
Well, I mean, this is an interesting thing with dementia and particularly and Alzheimer's, which is what mum had, very early stages of Alzheimer's. And mum had other issues. She had heart problems, so she might not have been getting oxygen all the time as much as she needed. So it's a little bit complicated. People go up and down. They have good days and not good days, like all of us. They have times when they're exhausted. So when are you going to test them? And yes, it just doesn't always come out. So she might be tested that time. She gets 22 out of 30. But then the next time she'll get 27. And another time, way along when she was more advanced, she got 29 out of 30.
So these are really of only very limited use then, I suppose, the kind of tests that she went through then, really. I mean, not
they must serve some purpose.
Some purpose, yeah.
And clearly if you've dropped to a very low level and you can't say your address or where you live, that's indicative of a particular level you're at. And mum, I must stress, was very early stages of Alzheimer's.
Were professionals by and large helpful, though, through this process?
There's some extraordinary people in this whole medical area. Incredible. Some of the people we had were just incredible. And what I found, the more specialised people were, the better the reading of mum, the better the understanding of where mum was at and what strategies we might be able to develop. So a geriatrician would get a... We felt we did much better with a geriatrician than, say, someone who's not specialised in that.
So throughout this process of your mum's been getting testing, how long was it before the doctors were able to reach a diagnosis to actually identify her as having Alzheimer's?
We would have started in the September, and it was probably about the February. Yeah, so about 5 months. But they did say that it was really early stages, so she could keep driving.
Keep living in her own home?
Keep living in her own home, but it just meant that she would need a few supports. But what happened, because Mum was 88, you know, people don't get Alzheimer's in isolation. They have all the other things that ageing might bring on. So Mum had other medical conditions like vascular system and things like that. So if she goes down with one thing or gets an infection, then that would, of course, affect her memory too. So then it might take her a few weeks to pick up. So officially she might have a score that she's reasonably okay.
Right.
But then she's dropped down and they won't... It's not a good idea to test someone when they're the most vulnerable. You want them to come back up. But that means then the family or whoever is trying to help someone that needs a lot more care. And that was one of the tricky things.
Oh, I see. So if she gets ill or sick or injured with something else, then she's got to remember to look after herself into recovering from that or even treating it or maintaining that. So that gets very complicated then, really complicated.
It does. And I must say that the people who just helped me so much with advice and that were Alzheimer's, the National Dementia Helpline, they were extraordinary. I used to ring up sometimes and just in tears, and sometimes you just want someone to listen. Because you've still, as a carer, look, my mum was fabulous. Her personality didn't change. She was very appreciative. This just started off, Richard. She asked me would I accompany her to some medical things. This is how this whole journey started. So I was just taking her to a couple of medical appointments and the whole thing just snowballed.
So when she was diagnosed with Alzheimer's, did the doctor tell her, did she need to hear that from you as well, that she had Alzheimer's?
Yes, that's really interesting. We went to a memory clinic, and there's many of them, and the geriatrician and the social worker there, they were fantastic to Mum. And they were so gentle and they spoke to Mum in a way that Mum made the decision that she wouldn't work anymore. And because she'd had an infection and been in hospital, that she wouldn't drive until she'd had an assessment, but that might take her a couple of months to get better. But they worked that out in a beautiful way with her, that she was part of the process. I was so impressed. I have thanked them so many times. I've written to them. I've run into one of the geriatricians when I happen to be at the hospital for something else. And I just feel like I want to fly at them and hug them, you know, from a running start.
But how about you? Did she need to hear that from you, though?
Yes, she did. Thought? One day she said to me, we'd been doing all these things and I'd be at work. So that's the thing, as the carer, you've still got your work and your life to do as well. So you're making these little phone calls, reminder phone calls all the time. And then one day when I was at work and reminding her about something else, and she said to me, Michelle, do you think I really do have a problem with my memory? And it really hit me. You know, all these medical people can tell Mum that she has a problem, but she really needs to hear it from me.
This is your mum who once told you, young lady, you're not going to the football to see that 100th goal.
Yeah.
You're going to brownies. I'm telling you to do that because I'm your mother.
Yeah.
Was there a reversal of roles there, and was she okay with that, if there was?
Yeah, she, you know, a lot of women born around the pre-depression, really, she was born in the 20s, they're very stoic. Very, very stoic. And when I was doing some research and I found so many of those women lost children. My mum's oldest, well, my oldest brother, he only lived a very short time. And many of the women, but they got on with their lives. They didn't have all the supports that are possible now. They just learnt to be stoic. But what I saw in this process, my mum lost a little bit of her edge. She softened a bit. And she was so glad to have someone accompany her, to have me, you know, going around that medical maze with her, that it actually enhanced the relationship.
So you became more like a partnership then? Is that what it was?
We were very much a partnership.
So did you... I suppose when I look at this on the outside, it seems like a really distressing and horrible thing, but there was another side to this process then,
absolutely.
It sounds like, for you, where you became much closer to your mum.
Absolutely. I mean, you don't think it at the time. I mean, I put one quote in the book. I would have liked it at the front. When you're up to your ass in crocodiles, it's hard to remember you came to drain the swamp. And that's what it feels like all the time, that you're so far behind. I'm trying to achieve this with mum and this happens. And you are. And you could be, a lot of carers are professional in their own field, but they're thrust into all this and they don't know how the system works. They don't know how to get their way through it. A lot of the medical professionals, they don't have a lot of time. In a hospital, they're so busy. How are they going to communicate with you?
So did you have time to enjoy your mum through this period?
Well,
that's a funny, is it a funny thing to ask? I don't know.
But for me, what's really important is accompanying the people that you love. And so what? Sometimes that's up, sometimes that's down. Just get on with it and accompany them. So we're all going to die. We live longer and we take longer to die. It's that simple. Not everyone with Alzheimer's means they're going to die, but because Mum had the vascular problem as well, and she'd had open heart surgery.
She was 88.
And she was 88.
Yeah, that's not going to have a happy ending.
Well,
not that kind of happy ending anyway, where everything's fine.
So why would I stop accompanying her? I mean, that would be crazy. But having said that, you know, carers do amazing things, and a lot more people do a lot more than I ever did. Mine was very short-term. Mum's personality didn't change, so she was very easy to be around. But I think it's really important as a carer to say what you can do and you can't. Mum would not have been okay living with me. It would have driven me over the edge.
So she stayed in the family home then for this time?
She stayed there until the August.
What kind of support did she need in order to be someone 88 with Alzheimer's still living alone in that home?
Well, she had quite a few supports. We got her Meals on Wheels, which Meals on Wheels is so fabulous because it means someone's actually coming to the house. So checking. We had people doing cleaning. The church community was fantastic to her.
I mean, I suppose you live in terror of something as simple as her leaving the iron on. Did you have to take the iron away and the stove and those kinds of things?
Well, things develop and you have to sort of just go with the whole process and see what's next. So one time I said I'd be over to pick up the car and I didn't come till later, and there she is sitting in the driveway in the car at night. Like, what's she doing? And she said, I didn't think you were coming. I was going to back it back. But because she hadn't driven at night for over 12 months, she didn't know where to put the gear stick because it wasn't lighting up. So
I have to ask, why do we let people who are 88 with Alzheimer's drive a car?
When she had early stages, she was assessed. She did a driving test and everything. I mean, she had very early stages Alzheimer's. So it's really important not to take people's independence and everything away from them. She was tested to make sure her reflexes were okay. So, yeah.
As she got worse, tell me about it. She once cancelled her memory clinic appointment. How did you find out about that?
Oh, that drove me nuts. She was trying to hang on to independence. And then we'd say, well, you know, we have to wait a couple of months for these appointments. And then I'd ring her in the morning to remind her, and she said, oh, no, we're not going today. I cancelled that. What? We've waited 2 months. These are the experts. These are the people who'll help me and you work out strategies. Yeah, and I'd ring them back, and they'd say, yeah, we thought it was strange, and we knew you were copied in. So
why did she cancel it?
I think a couple of things. Mum loved a wee brandy. So one of the things was, at night, I mean, we never worked out this, how to actually Like, I'd be with her and she would have, we'd have two brandies and we'd make them half strength, right? But I remember one night, so we'd had our two and that was it. And she said, oh, I need another. And I said, but you've had your two. When? When did I have my other one? Looking in the glass as if who stole it,
right. Mm.
And that was something that alcohol intake, we could never figure out. So sometimes I'd get there and she'd say, oh, Michelle, I'd ring her in the morning, Mum, we've got this appointment, we're doing this. And I think, you know, sometimes I'd find the brandy bottle leaning on the sink and I think maybe she had a few and...
Just thought, I'm fine.
I'm fine and wasn't fine. Right. And next morning she wasn't. I mean, there's
sometimes
lots
I feel
of,
fine after a brandy
yeah.
too. So, you
know. So there's lots of little things like that. Mm.
She had something like a forgetfulness jar, not a swear jar, but a forgetfulness jar. How did that work?
Richard, this is so beautiful. We had in the kitchen, we had this, it looked like a cupboard, but it was a bar. You couldn't tell it was a bar till you pressed the cupboard and you opened up. Anyway, my partner, who's my husband now, he really loved Mum. They got on well together bantering. So he came over with me one night and I said, we're going out, but let's just have a wee brandy with Mum before we go out. So he opens the bar up and there's this, say like a huge glass, and it's like a palm tree but filled with money, $5, $10, $20 notes. And he said to her, Jean, what's this for? And she said, oh, that's for St. Anthony. Every time I can't find something, I put $5 in. It's for the poor box. And when I really can't find something, I put $10 or $20 in. And he said, there must be hundreds of dollars in here. It was just, you know, I mean, I think that kind of scene sums up how people, it's so insightful.
You were a translator, as you said, in El Salvador. Mm-hmm. And you would often be a translator for a woman who'd suffered terribly. Mm-hmm. In that civil war in El Salvador. You liken that role of being a translator to being a carer.
Mm.
What's the similarity there?
I think with an interpreter, you have to listen. I mean, I interpreted, first of all, let me say, I was never good enough to be an interpreter. But in a country like that, you don't have the resources, so I'd end up so often out of my depth, but needing to do it. So... when you listen to someone whose life has so much tragedy and slaughter and loss, you sort of don't exist in the sense because when they're talking and you go on the site where this happened, you're listening. And then as soon as they stop speaking, you have to then tell their story and get the spirit of it because sometimes words don't translate well. So you have to kind of pick up the spirit of that as well. So it's sort of as if you had to deliver the spirit of their message, and certainly at a community level. That's my understanding. And
so you're like a voice that can be better understood then, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, well, if that person can't speak English, that's a way. And that woman, her name was Rafina Amaya, and she said, like my mum, she loved Mary, the Virgin Mary. As long as she was alive, she'd keep telling her story. So it was very important to her to keep telling that story. So, and with Mum, the same thing as a carer, you see what this person needs. The medical system and the aged care system, they can't pick up everything. So your job then is to become an advocate for them, to recognise what's needed and to set about being a logistical wizard to try and get as much of that as you can to support that person. Because when Mum was at home, at times she was quite vulnerable.
How were you going throughout this period? I mean, how much of your life were you giving over to being your mum's carer? Was there anything left there?
Yes, there were. I mean, I had a wonderful partner and that made a big difference. And one of the things I did, Richard, is I love writing, so I wrote a journal. That was sort of a little place I could go and scream on the page, really. And it was from that journal that I ended up writing the book. So that was important. And I've got good friends. And the other thing, my husband often works from home when he's not doing field work. So because his business is from home, he needs to get away. So we would often put Mum in respite and then go away camping for a week, out to a national park, or like go to Lake Eyre and see the beautiful expansiveness of Australia and, you know, this other world, and just breathtakingly beautiful, and get energised and then come back.
Respite's so important for carers, isn't it?
That's important. What I learned. Yeah. I thought respite is for the person with Alzheimer's, but actually, or any other health issues, it's for the carer. I think we should have Be Nice to Carer Day once a week.
Once a week?
Mm.
Hug a carer.
Yeah.
Or give them a break, actually.
Give them a break.
When did she go? Your mum go from being just, you know, the odd lapse here and there, putting money in a forgetfulness jar, to being a more serious person with dementia,
I think it's as her health deteriorated. She was on a lot of medication and the heart tablet. She built up a toxicity. And there are a lot of other things contributing. So as she would go down physically, then that would affect her cognitive ability and her memory. So all these things are interplaying. It's not just a one thing. And basically, she went in hospital. I was trying to look after her, and she wasn't getting enough oxygen, and her sodium levels were low. Look, I'm not a medical expert, so you'll have to forgive me on that. But in the end, I tried a locum, I tried the GP, I tried everything, and I rang the ambulance, and they put her in
the hospital. Her nighty caught fire one day.
That time when she was sitting in the car and trying to back it back because she thought I wasn't coming, her nighty she'd left on a heater. And because she'd taken so long, that had all become singed. And I just went in the room before I left, and like smoke everywhere, and oh my goodness, what's this? So there were incidents like that. And also when she was in hospital, she had a fall in hospital. She had a few falls and they had to stitch her head, and she lost a lot of confidence there, and it hurt her back, and she had to go into rehab. And so it was just this, not just the Alzheimer's, lots of other things happening too.
What was it like for you to watch her personality just fall away?
Her personality didn't fall away.
Well, I don't mean her personality, I suppose herself then, though. I mean,
yeah.
I mean her memory and her knowledge of what was what, and maybe even who you were.
We never got to that stage. She knew exactly who I was. So I just accept, perhaps because I've lived in a country that's very poor, and they have a saying in El Salvador sometimes that death's the hardest worker. It weaves in and out the population. So I'm not afraid to see a dead body. I know we're all going to die. That side of thing doesn't worry me. What was important to me later on when she started to be fearful, I think she knew the end was near, was how to lessen that fear for her. And sometimes all we can do, Richard, is just be present. We can't fix anything. We can't do anything. Just be present.
Were you with her when she died, Michelle?
I was. Mm. And another friend, a really close friend of mine too.
How easily did she let go of that?
That was a really interesting process the last few days, because I was in Vietnam and then she had another fall in hospital. So I got the phone call, so I came back. And, yeah, because it was Christmas, there was a backlog with the radiographers, so they didn't know what had happened in her head, but she was had a bleed on the brain and slowly just deteriorated. And you just get used to a new normal. Like, to other people, she wasn't speaking much, but you'd say, "You in pain?" And she'd say, "Boy." And you go, "Mum, do you mean, oh, boy, it's a bit sore?" Mm. Yeah. So I could read her like I knew her, and it's I just have to say, certainly in the case of accompanying my mother, it was an extraordinary experience to be there as she was dying. And I didn't actually think she was dying. I thought, you know, she's going to go on and on. She always does. But I didn't want her to live if she didn't have speech, and she wouldn't like that. And then they told me on the Wednesday, "Oh, go home and you're going to have to find her a high care place." And then I spent all Thursday morning. I had a friend sit with her. And on the Thursday morning when I got in there, after making all these phone calls between Christmas and New Year when nobody's around and they can't tell you if there's any place high care available, I went in, and as soon as I saw her, I knew she's getting ready to leave this world. And it was an amazing experience, Richard.
How did you know?
It's like This may sound very odd, but I can only speak with honesty from what I experienced. It's as if she was being called, as if someone, people she knew or something, were coming to get her. She'd sort of glaze. She was leaving our world, but there was something. And she'd have little moments of fear and hang on to you, but then let go. And we grew up with a prayer, a Catholic prayer, the Hail Mary. And I said to her, she was supposed to have lost all speech, or just about all speech. And I said, what can I do for her? And I was just sitting there and I said, Mum, would you like me to say Hail Mary? In full voice, for an hour and a half, every 5 minutes, she would rattle. She'd beat me through the Hail Mary. And the end of the Hail Mary is, now and at the hour of our death, amen. And I'm like, pray for our sinners now. And Mum's ripping through them. You think, this is extraordinary. Where did this? And the priest came in and she sat up on one elbow and she did this prayer that I have never heard. I don't know what it was. And then the next morning she died. It wasn't just, yeah, just peacefully.
I've spoken to people who've cared for parents or a partner who died from Alzheimer's, and it can be very distressing for the carer to see that personality fall away, which wasn't quite so much the case for you. But I wonder sometimes, I know there are moments of great fear for the person who has Alzheimer's, but sometimes I wonder if they're really having such a bad time of it. I don't know, what do you think about all that with Alzheimer's?
It's very interesting, isn't it? I had this woman I met in a bookshop and she said, oh yeah, my mum had that. And she said it was so freeing for her. She could finally say everything she wanted to say and be who she wanted to be.
Was your mum like that? Could she suddenly, did her tongue get a bit loosened?
Mum had always been like that. She'd always said exactly what you wanted to say. When I bought my first house with my husband now, I rang her to say, Mum, it was only probably about 6 years ago, so 2 years before she died, Mum. We've just bought a house. We went to an auction and we hadn't planned it and we've bought a house. And it's got 3 bedrooms and beautiful trees and da, 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 da. And I said, and it's weatherboard. And she said, you'll brick it up, won't you?
That's such a Barry Humphries thing to say. It's quite an Edna Everett thing to say, actually. You want a nice brick home. Right, yeah. Of course. Oh, that's fantastic. After she finally died, passed away.
She died. Richard, let's say it. She died.
Yeah, absolutely. How are you afterwards? I mean, often they say with carers, their health falls to pieces.
Well, 3 weeks after my partner proposed. So not only was I working out what to do with the contents of a house, but we had a wedding ceremony of which we had completely different ideas about what that should be. So
3 weeks after your mum died?
Yep.
You started planning a wedding?
Yep. Funeral, wedding.
Was that fantastic or was that just a bloody nightmare? I don't know, all that planning involved.
We've never had so many arguments. Let me leave it at that one.
Well, I suppose there's the day when you finally get married, though. Yeah, that must be lovely. Great. That must have been great.
It was fabulous.
Because there's no more planning to be done.
Absolutely. Weekends are free.
Did you know what to do with yourself once?
I always know what to do with myself.
Do you ever still get a sense of your mum's presence?
Absolutely, all the time. And two of the people closest to her, a sister who came in and Denise, who's in the story, that was a very good friend of mum, have both said to me in the last few weeks, they don't feel that she ever left. And I feel exactly the same.
In what way? How is her presence?
Maybe it's because we keep talking about her, but I don't feel she left. When Dad died, I felt a ripping gap. But not with Mum. And maybe it's because Mum was much older and I got to accompany her. And you get to a point you don't want the people to suffer.
It's been great to speak with you, Michelle. It's given me a lot to think about. Thank you so much for being my guest.
Thanks, Richard.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.